Hello everyone, Dr. Alex Vasquez here with Antiviral Strategies for Coronavirus. Here I will continue deciphering and deconstructing the phenomena of viral infections, providing insights that lead to better treatments. Today is March 4th of 2020. Antiviral strategies for the so-called new coronavirus 2019-2020 context. Here we are yet again, collectively acting like a bunch of scared idiots due to yet another international viral crisis. The illness is real, but when it is strategically mismanaged and strategically misrepresented, then any small problem can become an excuse for crisis, panic, international turmoil, and the rewriting of laws that restrict access to privacy, free speech, free travel, access to work and education. We, collectively, are failing to access the knowledge accumulated for decades in nutrition and biomedical sciences. Fear is the chosen tactic for politics and profiteering. So let's calm down and look at readily available options for safely and effectively managing viral infections. I will limit today's conversation to 6 interventions that are readily available for clinical use, clinical trials, and which can be used as comparators in what we can expect will be upcoming drug and vaccine trials. For practicality, in number 1, the rapid production of this video. Number 2, comprehension and utilization of this information. This video will be as short and practical as possible, perhaps a bit spontaneous and unpolished. I've discussed a lot of these concepts in other videos, which you can find on my website at inflammationmastery.com/antiviral. In 2019, I provided a new overview of the overall antiviral strategies and antiviral nutrition, and also a separate video of nearly 2 hours, specifically focusing on the nutrient N-acetylcysteine or acetylcysteine. Again, you can find both of those videos on my website, inflammationmastery.com/antiviral, and I'm basically reviewing and kind of refreshing the information that I published in 2014 in a digital ebook titled Antiviral Nutrition, and also in a full-color paper book called Antiviral Strategies and Immune Nutrition. In 2014, I published a small editorial or essay titled The Proof is in the Panic, We Need a New Strategy Against Viral Infections. And I'm going to refresh and summarize some of that information here. The recent, recurrent, ongoing, repetitive, and predictable international health crises due to viral infections have made very clear the fact that the international community needs to use different strategies to combat viral infections. Since 2014, fear and panic regarding various viral infections, such as Ebola, measles, mumps, enterovirus, acute flaccid paralysis, and now the new novel Chinese coronavirus, has been widely publicized, inappropriately politicized and weaponized, and or, per the concept of disaster capitalism, used for private profiteering. The fact that these viral infection health crises exist in these modern times is prima facie evidence of the failure of current systems and the need not for new treatments within the same model, but for a new model better suited for international distribution, disease prevention, and broad spectrum effectiveness. The multifaceted model presented originally in my book in 2014, Antiviral Strategies and Immune Nutrition, again published as an ebook titled Antiviral Nutrition, gives us 4 main areas upon which we can safely, affordably, effectively, and rapidly focus our efforts. Number 1, blocking viral acquisition by targeting the virus directly. Number 2, blocking viral replication. Number 3, supporting immune function. And number 4, supporting cellular and whole body health. These interventions have proven effectiveness, low cost, international availability, without the costs, delays, limited availability, and adverse effects of current and forecasted medical treatments. Here I'll discuss very briefly some of the microbiology of the coronavirus family. These are enveloped RNA viruses, and they contain the largest genome among RNA viruses. They undergo rapid mutation, especially where the soil and therefore the food and therefore the people and the animals are deficient in selenium, and this of course worsens the human-animal intertransfer and mutations. Generally speaking, these viruses are mostly benign, causing 15 to 30% of the common cold or the sniffles, which is runny nose, slight fatigue, and sneezing. This is the typical upper respiratory nose and throat infection. And unlike with other infections such as measles, infection with coronavirus does not result in durable and reliable immunity. So what does that tell you about the anticipated efficacy of vaccines against coronavirus? If the full infection with a living virus does not result in durable immunity, I'd be surprised if the vaccines are able to surpass the effectiveness of a natural infection. All infections tend to be more severe in elderly persons, diabetics, persons with pre-existing heart, lung, and renal diseases, and in people who are immunosuppressed for whatever reason, especially including non-obvious nutritional deficiencies, especially of vitamin D, selenium, vitamin A, protein, and zinc. Periodically, these coronaviruses have mutated into forms that are more aggressive. We saw that with the SARS coronavirus in 2003, the MERS coronavirus in 2012, and now again with the so-called novel China coronavirus, SARS-CoV-2, as it's now called, popularly known as the Chinese coronavirus these days. This virus emerged on December 1st of 2019, the exact same day that China mandated a new vaccine schedule. Here, very briefly, I'll discuss strategic failures of the medical paradigm, and especially, more specifically, in medical education. All consistently unaddressed failures are intentional failures. Consistent failures on anything related to nutrition, including but not limited to cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and obesity. Consistent failures in anything related to nutrition also applies to viral infections, as I'll show you throughout this video. Education in nutrition within medical education is consistently insufficient or completely absent, as you can see from the following citations. In 2014, I updated my antiviral protocol and titled it Antiviral Nutrition, and you can see an overview of that strategic plan right here. Step number one is addressing viral acquisition and viral entry or penetration into cells. So perhaps obviously, viruses cannot replicate on their own. They have to enter into a host cell and commandeer or hijack the cellular machinery, which then does the replication of the viruses. Viruses do not replicate on their own. They have to enter into a cell and kind of hijack the intracellular machinery of that cell for their replication. So if we stop the virus at the level of acquisition or cellular entry, then we've effectively stopped the virus. Once the virus has entered, we can try to stop replication, and we can do that by the use of skilled nutritional interventions. Step number three in my overall plan is addressing the immune response to improve that immune response against what in this case would be now an established viral infection. And we can also support cell and systemic health to combat some of the adverse effects of viral infections. So you can look at these individually, one through four, as I've illustrated here, and you'll also notice that these overlap one with the other. So certain nutrients, for example, may have an anti-replicative effect. They also may have a direct antiviral effect, and they also might stimulate the immune system while reducing systemic inflammation. So certain nutrients can be placed in all four categories of this overall antiviral strategy, whereas other nutrients might be more effective or exclusively effective in one particular area. For more details, you'll have to look at my antiviral nutrition strategy, published again as an ebook, Antiviral Nutrition, also a paper book, Antiviral Strategies and Immune Nutrition. Antiviral interventions, virus-directed versus host-directed. So here I'm going to discuss two different paradigms. Mostly the medical paradigm focuses exclusively on the virus with vaccines that are specific to each virus and antiviral drugs that are specific to each virus. In integrative medicine and functional medicine, we look at that, but we also look at host-directed interventions. And so I'll outline the distinctions between those two, perhaps on this page. Medical paradigm is virus-specific for limited use and maximum profit because they want to sell a different vaccine and a different drug for every single viral infection. Nearly all antiviral treatments used in medicine are doubly virus-specific in that, number one, these drugs target the virus and ignore the host, and number two, most of these drugs target a specific virus with very little crossover or carryover to other viral infections. Of course, all these start as patented drugs sold for maximum profit by a single manufacturer, at least until the patent expires. Likewise, vaccines are always highly specific to individual viruses and even isolated strains within a group of viruses. And obviously some vaccines are specific to bacteria, but they are nearly always by definition very specific. They don't provide general health improvement and they don't carry over to preventing other diseases. So again, the medical profession wants to sell a different treatment and a different preventive measure for each viral infection because that's obviously the way to maximize profit. This creates a huge market for products because each illness is considered to need its own vaccines and its own antiviral drugs. Separate from those used for other infections, this is why the vaccine schedule has exploded from a few vaccines to several dozen vaccines over the last couple of years. New drugs and new vaccines, especially when contextualized within an emergency or panic, are nearly always subjected to very low scrutiny and very enthusiastic endorsement because the medical profession needs products to sell and they want to give the appearance of addressing whatever the new concern is, which at this point we've had new viral emergencies virtually every year and sometimes every other year. The medical response relies largely but not exclusively on new products, just like any other industry such as the auto industry or the music industry. They always have to come out with something new to sell to kind of gain the attention of the public. Treating the actual host is considered a radical idea in medicine. So for example, a recent letter or commentary was published in The Lancet in 2020 in February titled Reducing Mortality from the 2019 Novel Coronavirus, Host-Directed Therapies Should Be an Option. They were presenting this as a somewhat novel idea. It should be obvious that we need to treat the human host who has whatever the infection is. Another aspect of the medical paradigm, which is, in this case, relying mostly on antiviral drugs and vaccines, is it's a simple message to communicate to people. This vaccine for this infection, this drug for this infection, simple mechanisms and easier understanding creates more use despite fewer benefits. In contrast, when we look at the host-focused model, treatment is mostly, but not exclusively, focused on manipulable targets in host physiology, such as barrier defense, stopping viral replication, promoting the immune response, and also managing and improving and supporting cellular and systemic health. These overlapping mechanisms require a more complex and nuanced understanding, ultimately providing better use and more benefits, but people, patients, and doctors have to cross a certain intellectual threshold in order to understand how these host-focused interventions work. Again, the host-focused model, which relies strongly on nutrition, has many overlapping mechanisms. This requires a more complex understanding, but ultimately provides better intervention and more benefits. From the videos I made in late 2019, I discussed the pharmacocentric or medical paradigm, and that is healthcare centers around drugs and surgery. Drugs are the assumed or presumptive solutions to all health problems, regardless of dangers, costs, inefficacy, or the existence of better options not taught in medical school and residency. If any better solution is not a drug or vaccine, then it is not considered a, quote, realistic, unquote, solution. You can access this video on my website, inflammationmastery.com/antiviral, and you can also directly download the video file. So I'm now going to begin discussing reasonable antiviral interventions for coronavirus. We're going to look at the research. I'll give you my opinion on how valid some of this might be and what I might personally do in this situation. Again, I could tell you about several dozen interventions, nutrients, botanicals, minerals, vitamins, and drugs that we could use in an antiviral strategy, but for the sake of simplicity and expediency, in this particular presentation, I'm really going to focus in on six interventions that I think are the most important. Starting, of course, with general nutrition support, including at least a competent professional level multivitamin and multimineral supplement, adequate protein in the diet, avoiding foods that induce hyperglycemia. So anytime someone consumes a large carbohydrate load or simple sugars, that, of course, creates elevation in blood sugar. We call that, of course, hyperglycemia. That alone causes immune suppression. So anytime people eat junk foods or high carbohydrate foods, they are suppressing their immune response. Number four here, avoiding processed, low-nutrient, high-calorie, high-carbohydrate foods. If people want to take vitamin C, sure, we could certainly support that. Possibly the nutrient supplement resveratrol might provide some benefit. We'll look at that research in just a moment. I'm more interested in focusing on these particular considerations, vitamin D, vitamin A, zinc, selenium, NAC or acetylcysteine, which is a form of a natural amino acid, and glycyrrhizin from licorice root. Those are going to be the six nutrients and botanicals that I focus on specifically in what I hope is a pretty fast and simple presentation here. So briefly, we'll take a look at this article from 2003. This was published in Journal of Antimicrobial Chemotherapy, Vitamin C and the SARS Coronavirus. I think taking vitamin C is a pretty good idea. One of the ways that vitamin C helps when people have viral infections is that vitamin C helps to detoxify and therefore lower histamine levels. The release of histamine is increased when people have viral infections, but histamine itself actually causes immune suppression. So if we can detoxify and therefore eliminate and lower those elevated histamine levels, we actually help the immune system work better because it's not being inhibited by histamine. So vitamin C helps to lower histamine levels, and that's one of the ways that it helps people recover from viral infections. 1 to 2 grams three times a day would be a total dose of either 3 grams up to 6 grams. I think that's totally reasonable and totally safe for the majority of people, excepting those people who have iron overload. I invite you to pause the video and read everything that's printed on this page. I'm going to keep making progress for the sake of speed and efficiency. Resveratrol is a botanical extract that has shown some activity against one of the coronaviruses, the MERS coronavirus. You can see this article was published in Biomed Central Infectious Diseases 2017 in February. I think that if a person wants to take some extra resveratrol to improve immune defenses, I think that's very reasonable. I'm not convinced of its efficacy because we don't, to my knowledge, have any clinical trials showing that it actually works. But if you wanted to use resveratrol within an overall antiviral strategy and antiviral nutrition strategy using other nutrients like vitamin D and vitamin A and selenium and acetylcysteine, I think that would be very reasonable. Again, you can pause the video to read everything I've typed here. I'm going to keep making progress so I can focus in on the things that I think are actually more important, starting here right now with vitamin D. So starting on this page, I'll slow down just a little bit and try to get into more detail regarding these interventions that I think are worthy of clinical consideration and probably implementation. So in this study, vitamin D was shown to have effectiveness against a specific coronavirus that infects pigs. Vitamin D supplementation was shown to alleviate intestinal damage and reduce certain markers and pathways related to inflammation. So my comment with regard to this study is that, as expected, via the numerous barrier-supporting anti-inflammatory and anti-replicative effects of vitamin D, supplementation with this vitamin hormone was shown to alleviate this coronavirus-induced disease in this animal model. In humans, low vitamin D status in children increases risk for rotaviral diarrhea, which is somewhat related to this, while vitamin D supplementation to alleviate vitamin D deficiency protects against respiratory infections, according to a well-conducted review and meta-analysis recently published in the British Medical Journal in 2017. Let's take a look at that on the following page. So the conclusion from this meta-analysis is that vitamin D supplementation was safe and it protected against acute respiratory tract infection overall. Now, some of those respiratory tract infections were undoubtedly coronavirus because coronavirus causes 15 to 30% of viral upper respiratory tract infections in humans. So the fact that they were able to show that vitamin D reduces the risk and incidence of respiratory infections pretty much suggests, although it doesn't directly prove, that vitamin D would also help against coronavirus infections in humans. Patients who were very vitamin D deficient and those not receiving bolus doses experienced the most benefit. So again, patients who are deficient and who then supplement with vitamin D experience the most benefit. Also, patients who take their vitamin D supplements on a regular basis, at least every week, if not every day, receive more benefit than patients who receive a huge bolus dose, like 100,000 or 200,000, up to 300,000 international units at one time. That is much less effective than periodic, daily, or weekly dosing with vitamin D. So again, I'll read the quotes that I highlighted and excerpted here. Conclusions, vitamin D supplementation was safe and it protected against acute respiratory tract infection overall. Patients who were very vitamin D deficient and those not receiving bolus doses experienced the most benefit. Again, this probably has applicability to coronavirus, given that 15 to 30% of upper respiratory viral infections are due to coronavirus in humans. Conclusions and policy implications. Our study reports a major new indication for vitamin D supplementation, the prevention of acute respiratory tract infection. We also show that people who are very deficient in vitamin D and those receiving daily or weekly supplementation without additional bolus doses experience particular benefit. Our results add to the body of evidence supporting the introduction of public health measures such as food fortification to improve vitamin D status. And I'm sure that many of you know, in 2004, I published a major review on vitamin D, the clinical importance of vitamin D, cholecalciferol, a paradigm shift with implications for all healthcare providers. This was published in Alternative Therapies and Health and Medicine in September, October of 2004. And what I stated then is still accurate now, 16 years later. Until proven otherwise, the balance of research clearly indicates that oral supplementation in the range of 1,000 international units per day for infants, 2,000 international units per day for children, and 4,000 international units per day for adults is safe and reasonable to meet physiologic requirements to promote optimal health and to reduce the risk of several serious diseases. Safety and effectiveness of supplementation are assured by periodic monitoring of serum 25-hydroxyvitamin D and serum calcium. So again, for adults, the typical dose is 4,000 international units. For larger adults and obese adults, we might go as high as 10,000 international units in order to meet their particular physiologic needs. And you can download this article from various websites, including my academia page. Also, ichnfm.org/D contains an essay that I wrote in 2017. This article was very popular, so if you simply Google for the title along with my name, I'm sure you'll come up with this article. Let's take a look here at some more information specifically relevant to vitamin D and the prevention of respiratory tract infections in humans. Mechanisms of vitamin D in infectious disease include enhances the effect of vitamin A, improves barrier defense, integrity, secretory IgA, and antimicrobial peptides, improves the gut microbiota, and that has an overall anti-inflammatory effect, enhances nonspecific innate immunity for improved defense against infection, modulates specific adaptive immunity for improved defense against infection, also with less autoimmune and inflammatory consequences. Again, it reduces systemic inflammation and reduces specifically brain inflammation or neuroinflammation. Improves mitochondrial function and also improves muscle strength and actually elevates testosterone levels in certain patient populations. Benefits clinically that we see with vitamin D in clinical practice: improves mood, alleviates depression, reduces seizures and migraine headaches, reduces hypertension and can alleviate certain types of heart failure, reduces hyperglycemia, diabetes, and promotes weight loss, alleviates back pain, limb pain, and so-called fibromyalgia in this context, helps prevent and alleviate various autoimmune diseases such as multiple sclerosis and rheumatoid arthritis, and has been shown to reduce the incidence of type 1 diabetes by an amazing 78%. Reduces the incidence and recurrence of various types of cancer. So again, further justification for using vitamin D against coronavirus infection in humans: long history of use and clinical experience, documented safety in various patient, age, and disease groups, affordable internationally, widely available internationally, efficacy against coronavirus has been shown at least in an experimental model, specifically referencing the porcine epidemic diarrhea coronavirus. Human studies have shown efficacy against a wide range of human viruses, including HIV, HPV, and viral hepatitis. Also, again, efficacy against a wide range of human bacterial and viral respiratory infections, and the collateral benefits that I already mentioned. Again, enhancing the action of vitamin A, improving barrier defenses, improving the gut microbiota, enhancing nonspecific innate immunity, and modulating specific adaptive immunity to make it more effective for defense with less specific autoimmunity. Reduces systemic inflammation and neuroinflammation, improves mitochondrial function, improves muscle strength, and in some cases elevates testosterone levels. Improves mood and alleviates depression clinically, also reduces seizures and migraine headaches. reduces hypertension, alleviates heart failure, reduces hyperglycemia, and promotes weight loss. Alleviates back pain, limb pain, and systemic pain, which can sometimes look like fibromyalgia, even though fibromyalgia is obviously different from vitamin D deficiency. Helps prevent and alleviate various autoimmune diseases such as multiple sclerosis and rheumatoid arthritis. Again, an amazing 78% reduction in type 1 diabetes and reduces the incidence and recurrence of various types of cancer. You will never see such a wide range of clinically important improvements with any vaccine or any drug. Now let's take a look at vitamin A. How could we justify giving vitamin A against coronavirus? Well, first of all, vitamin A isn't specific to any virus, despite the fact that the American Academy of Pediatrics seems to think that vitamin A is specific only for measles infection. So from the American Academy of Pediatrics in 1993, the World Health Organization and the United Nations International Children's Emergency Fund issued a joint statement recommending that vitamin A be administered to all children diagnosed with measles in community where vitamin A deficiency is a recognized problem and where mortality related to measles is greater than 1%. The recommended regimen is 100,000 international units by mouth at the time of diagnosis for infants younger than 12 months and 200,000 international units for older children. So we should be using high-dose vitamin A supplementation for virtually all types of acute infections, not simply measles, and I'll justify that a bit more here. Again, similar to vitamin D, we see a long history of use, very well studied, documented safety, affordable, widely available internationally, efficacy against a wide range of human viruses because we're not targeting the virus, we're improving host defense. Efficacy against a wide range of bacterial and viral respiratory infections. Vitamin D and vitamin A work together functionally to promote immunity and tolerance, so that's promoting immune defense, but also calming down what might otherwise be an excessive inflammatory or immune response. Vitamin D and vitamin A actually work together at the same nuclear transcription factor and receptor. Because vitamin A functions at a physiological level by improving overall defenses and improving overall health, we might say, you'll never see any drug or vaccine provide these same level of benefits. Let's take a look here at another document from the World Health Organization website. Vitamin A is essential for multiple functions, including for development and maintenance of normal vision. Vitamin A is required for gene expression, normal immune function, growth and development, and for the maintenance and proliferation of epithelial cells, such as in the respiratory tract. That includes the nose, throat, lungs, and also gastrointestinal tract. Subclinical, which is to say a mild deficiency of vitamin A, results in increased susceptibility to common infectious diseases. An estimated 1.3 to 2.5 million infant and preschool deaths annually can be attributed to vitamin A deficiency, and therefore those diseases could be prevented with widespread use of vitamin A supplementation. Vitamin A supplementation is commonly administered alongside vaccines, but then the drug pushers give all the credit to the vaccines. Without mentioning vitamin A, without acknowledging the safety and effectiveness of vitamin A supplementation, and without advocating for nutritional supplementation to prevent and treat a wide range of infectious and non-infectious diseases. Now let's take a little detour here away from vitamins, and we're going to talk about glycyrrhizin, which is an active component extracted from licorice root. So let's look at the details from this study published in The Lancet in June of 2003. Glycyrrhizin from licorice inhibits entry and replication of the SARS-associated coronavirus in vitro, which means this is a test tube study, so to speak, certainly not a human clinical trial. Of all the compounds, glycyrrhizin was the most active in inhibiting replication of the SARS-associated coronavirus. Our findings suggest that glycyrrhizin should be assessed for treatment of SARS coronavirus. They also noticed that the licorice extract glycyrrhizin inhibits binding and penetration of the virus, which are early and essential steps in any viral infection. So my perspective on this research is as follows. Licorice has been used medicinally for thousands of years, often at doses that are considered therapeutic by modern standards. Licorice directly inhibits many different DNA and RNA viruses while also stimulating nonspecific immune defenses. Glycyrrhizin also shows activity against Japanese encephalitis virus, herpes simplex, HIV, and hepatitis C viruses. Especially for short-term use during acute viral infections, glycyrrhizin's pseudoaldosterone effect manifesting as hypertension and hypokalemia, which is low potassium levels, should be either mild and irrelevant or easily manageable. So again, glycyrrhizin from licorice has been used in human clinical care and human clinical studies against many different types of viruses. It's very safe, and the few adverse effects that it has are easy to diagnose and manage. Let's look at another study here. This is a review article, Antiviral Effects of Glycyrrhiza Species. Again, this is what's more commonly referred to as licorice. This is a review article published in 2008. Historical sources for the use of Glycyrrhiza species include ancient manuscripts from China, India, and Greece. They all mention its use for symptoms of viral, respiratory tract infections, and hepatitis. In vitro studies revealed antiviral activity against HIV, SARS-related coronavirus, respiratory syncytial virus, arboviruses, vicinivirus, and vesicular stomatitis virus. The authors also commented that vaccines and antiviral drugs will fail to meet global needs at least at the beginning of a severe influenza A virus pandemic. Anti-inflammatory and immunomodulatory agents are considered to be important candidates as constituents of anti-influenza treatment strategies. In that last sentence, they're specifically referring to nutritional and botanical interventions. If we look at their table summarizing some of the human clinical trials, we see effectiveness of licorice against hepatitis B virus, hepatitis C virus, and also HIV infection. Now let's change topics again and focus in on zinc for inhibiting coronavirus activity in vitro. So in vitro means like test tube study, basically, sometimes using cell cultures. So I'm going to focus in on some of the clinical aspects of using zinc in the prevention and treatment of acute infections. The authors of this study stated increased intracellular zinc concentrations are known to efficiently impair replication of a number of RNA viruses. And as I've said before, coronavirus is an RNA virus. So I'll provide you some of my clinical perspectives. This in vitro study provides mechanistic insight into zinc's ability to inhibit coronavirus replication. For people needing, quote, specific evidence that zinc fights coronavirus, they now have it. More generally, zinc deficiency is common in the general population worldwide. Zinc deficiency contributes directly to increased mortality, which is death, from a wide range of infectious diseases. Zinc supplementation is repeatedly shown to reduce mortality from a wide range of infectious diseases. Zinc is necessary for maintenance of barrier defense. Conversely, and obviously therefore, zinc deficiency impairs barrier defense and increases the risk for infectious diseases. So hopefully you remember when I was talking about four parts to my overall antiviral strategy, part number one is targeting the virus specifically. And when I talk about targeting the virus, I'm talking about things that can either kill or neutralize the virus directly or block its entry. And what I just said about zinc is that zinc helps to improve the strength of those barriers so that the viruses cannot enter for cellular replication. Zinc is necessary for production of the thymus gland hormone called thymulin, which itself is necessary for maintenance of various immune functions. Zinc deficiency increases the risk for infectious diseases via immunosuppression, via thymulin insufficiency. So in other words, for the immune system to work properly, it needs to have this hormone called thymulin produced from the thymus gland. In order for the thymus gland to produce thymulin to support immune function, it has to have zinc. If people are zinc deficient, they are virtually by definition immunosuppressed, and that's one of the ways that they're more vulnerable to different types of infection. Also, point number six here, zinc ions have been shown to be directly virucidal against, for example, the rhinovirus, which is another cause of the common cold. Zinc inhibits the NF-kappa B pathway that is commonly hijacked to promote viral replication. Point number eight, zinc provides antioxidant benefits by functioning as a cofactor for enzymes such as superoxide dismutase. Reasonable adult doses during acute infection can be 30 to 50 milligrams per day. Perhaps higher. Extended supplementation with zinc should be accompanied by supplementation with copper, 2 to 4 milligrams, to avoid zinc-induced copper deficiency, which might result in a paradoxical zinc-induced copper deficiency-mediated immunosuppression. And this is observable clinically via relative or pending neutropenia. So let me see if I can break that down just a little bit for maybe an easier explanation for those of you who haven't studied laboratory medicine, for example. When people consume zinc supplements, one of the consequences for relatively higher doses of zinc supplementation, like 30 to 50 milligrams, is that that reduces the efficiency of absorption of copper in the gastrointestinal tract. Now, that could promote a copper deficiency. The consequence of copper deficiency is immunosuppression, and we can see that clinically by looking at a blood test called a complete blood count with differential, which shows us that the neutrophil count, which is a type of white blood cell, starts to decrease as people become progressively more copper deficient. So again, the paradox here is that what could happen is when we use zinc to support immune function, because a lot of people are zinc deficient, if it's not done correctly, people could end up with a copper deficiency that then causes them to be immune impaired. So we need to use the zinc supplementation within a context that ensures adequate intake of copper, usually in the range of 2 to 4 milligrams per day. Very briefly here, I'll show you a document from the World Health Organization, one of their publications. This was a book published back in 2004, and I'm going to discuss that on the following slide. So how do we justify the use of zinc in the clinical prevention or treatment of coronavirus infection? Number one, zinc deficiency is common in the global population and increases risk for death, infectious diseases, and other problems, ranging from eczema to mental depression. Research conducted during the past 10 to 15 years suggests that zinc deficiency is widespread and affects the health and well-being of populations worldwide. Results of our review, that I'll show you the citation for in just a moment, indicate that zinc deficiency in children less than 5 years of age increases the risk for the incidence of diarrhea disease by a factor of 1.28, increases the risk for pneumonia by a factor of 1.5, and increases the risk for malaria also by, in this case, 1.56. The global prevalence of zinc deficiency was estimated at 31%, and again, zinc deficiency is estimated to cause 176,000 diarrhea deaths, 406,000 pneumonia deaths, and 207,000 malaria deaths. This was published in 2004 by the World Health Organization. And now let's take that data and apply it to adults living in a so-called developed country such as the United States. Here they estimate that 30 to 40% of elderly subjects in Detroit, Michigan have mild to moderate zinc deficiency. These patients respond via significant anti-inflammatory cardioprotective benefits to supplementation with zinc at 45 milligrams per day, which is very consistent with the level of supplementation I suggested earlier for adults at 30 to 50 milligrams per day. So here they used 45 milligrams per day in American adults who have an estimated prevalence of 30 to 40% for zinc deficiency, and they found clinically important benefits. So those patients would have only shown benefit to receiving zinc supplementation if indeed they had been previously zinc deficient. So again, what I'm showing you here and what you should be able to understand is that zinc deficiency is common worldwide in so-called underdeveloped countries, but it's also common in so-called developed countries. So we know that zinc deficiency impairs barriers, impairs immune function, and promotes the development of various types of infectious diseases. We also see that zinc deficiency is common worldwide, and it's obviously easily treatable by the use of nutritional supplements containing zinc. So if we're really going to try to make an effort to prevent and treat these coronavirus infections, we need to include zinc in any reasonable protocol. Conversely, when governments and journals and organizations talk about treating and preventing coronavirus and they refuse to consider nutrition, you know they're not really serious about trying to treat and prevent the illness. What they're trying to do is gain control over the narrative around that condition without being truly effective. Now I'll show you an image of that research itself. Zinc decreases C-reactive protein, which is a marker for inflammation, lipid peroxidation, and inflammatory cytokines in elderly subject. Some of those same inflammatory cytokines are part of the so-called cytokine storm that is an important aspect of the major clinical consequences of these pandemic viral infections. Again, they estimate that 30 to 40% of elderly subjects in Detroit, Michigan, in the United States, have mild to moderate zinc deficiency. These patients respond via significant anti-inflammatory cardioprotective benefits to 45 milligrams per day of zinc. The fact that they respond biochemically and objectively to zinc supplementation is evidence of a pre-existing zinc deficiency. Yes, the exact same deficiency that increases the risk for infections and death. So hopefully everyone understands the implications of that. Now, again, zinc does show specific activity against coronavirus, also general activity against a wide range of other viruses. We see that zinc deficiency is common in the global population, including developed nations such as the United States. Zinc deficiency contributes directly to increased mortality and death from a wide range of infectious diseases, and zinc supplementation provides protection. Zinc is necessary, for example, for the maintenance of barrier defense. It's also necessary for the production of the thymus hormone, thymulin, which supports and maintains immune function. Zinc ions are directly virucidal, specifically shown against rhinovirus. Zinc inhibits the NF-kappa-B inflammatory pathway and also provides antioxidant benefits. Again, for adults, especially short-term, reasonable supplementation is 30 to 50 milligrams per day. You might offset some of the impaired copper absorption with additional copper supplementation at 2 to 4 milligrams per day. Now let's talk about selenium. So we just talked about zinc. Now I'm switching gears to talk about a different mineral, in this case selenium. Well studied, especially in the treatment of HIV infection. And in this particular study, you can see they used selenium at 200 micrograms per day. That's a very common dose. I do not consider that to be the optimal dose, especially for patients who are already fighting an active viral infection. Selenium is very safe and widely used as a nutritional supplement. 200 micrograms per day is the most common dose in clinical trials, as I just showed you, and also in most high-potency nutritional supplements. Reasonable doses during viral infections might be up around 600 micrograms per day. Here's the biological and clinical rationale. Selenium is safe, well-studied, widely used, biologically and clinically potent, starting at about 200 micrograms per day. Selenium also provides anti-inflammatory benefits. As with many nutrients in my antiviral nutritional protocol, selenium inhibits the NF-kappa-B pathway that is both pro-inflammatory and, number two, commonly hijacked by viruses to promote their replication. During infectious events, including in this context coronavirus, excess free radical production and damage contributes to unnecessary inflammation that becomes a vicious cycle independent of the infection and immune response. This collateral damage serves no useful purpose, but it clearly contributes to disease pathogenesis and complications attributed to the infection. Thus, antioxidant therapy and nutritional supplementation during times of infection can help to limit this collateral and unproductive oxidant damage. As I've already stated, selenium blocks the NF-kappa-B pathway, and that helps to reduce viral replication. By neutralizing free radicals, selenium also helps to reduce the number of mutations, and that helps the immune system to defeat that virus. When viruses are in a pro-oxidant environment, they mutate more, and that promotes their escape from the immune system. Point number five, again, it's antioxidant. Point number six here, selenium provides gene regulatory benefits and intracellular signaling benefits. By helping to neutralize free radicals, many antioxidants help to normalize gene transcription and expression. And as you can see from this quote from 2007, the selenoenzyme thioredoxin reductase affects the redox regulation of several key enzymes, transcription factors, and receptors. Selenium deficiency decreases antibody titers and several aspects of cell-mediated immunity. Selenium supplementation can counteract these effects. Point number seven, selenium is also what I call lymphokinetic, which means that it helps to promote the movement of lymphatic flow and reduces secondary skin infections, especially in patients with lymphedema. Clinical uses of selenium supplementation include general antioxidant support, treatment of autoimmune thyroiditis, specifically Hashimoto thyroiditis, alleviation of anxiety, depression, and tiredness, treatment of lymphedema and prevention of secondary skin infections, elimination of Keishan disease in China, which is an endemic cardiomyopathy actually caused by an enterovirus, also elimination of Keishan-Beck disease, endemic disabling degenerative arthritis in Southeast Siberia, North Korea, and China. So why do we see so many of these viral infections arising from China? We see new pandemic viral infections arising from China, the 1957 Asian flu, the 1968 Hong Kong flu, the 2003 SARS coronavirus, and now we see the 2019 novel China coronavirus. Why do we see these pandemic viral infections arising from China? The terrain of China is famously deficient in selenium, and this selenium deficiency was eventually found to be the cause, for example, of Kashan disease, which is known to be caused in part by a mutated enterovirus. This disease has effectively been eliminated through widespread selenium supplementation. Research and treatment of Kashan disease irrefutably established the widespread selenium deficiency throughout many parts of China. I propose here, and very reasonably I might add, that the same selenium deficiency that causes Kashan disease and Kashin-Beck disease, both of which are endemic within China, that same selenium deficiency also increases viral mutagenesis and activity of these viruses that are specifically known to undergo interspecies transfer, development, mutation, and maturation. In other words, the endemic selenium deficiency that affects animals and humans in many regions of China creates an incubator or a perfect storm for the generation of these novel virus strains, which are mutations of previously mild viral infections. So I'm going to summarize that and repeat it one more time. I propose here that the same selenium deficiency already known to exist in China and some of the surrounding regions increases viral mutagenesis and activity of these viruses that are specifically known to undergo interspecies transfer development, mutation, and maturation. In other words, the endemic selenium deficiency that affects animals and humans in many regions around China creates an incubator or perfect storm for the generation of these novel mutated virus strains, which result in these pandemic viral infection outbreaks. So by this point in the presentation, I've talked about vitamin A, vitamin D, zinc, selenium, and the licorice extract called glycyrrhizin, very similar to glycyrrhizinic acid. I've also given some mention to vitamin C, typically 3 to 6 grams per day, and also the nutritional supplement resveratrol. So here and finally, I'm going to talk about the amino acid N-acetylcysteine, or simply acetylcysteine, as part of a 6-part minimum anti-coronavirus plan. I recently reviewed NAC or acetylcysteine in a video format of about 100 minutes, so almost 2 hours, more than an hour and a half, available for free viewing at my website inflammationmastery.com/antiviral. I'm not going to repeat that review here, except I took out maybe 5 pages out of the original 100 pages, and I'll take a look at those here with you right now. Again, see the videos at inflammationmastery.com/antiviral for more details. One of the case reports that I reviewed previously is this one from Annals of Internal Medicine 2010 in May. This is a case report of a woman who had severe H1N1 influenza and was treated with intravenous N-acetylcysteine, or again, acetylcysteine. Acetylcysteine is unique among nutrients in that it's commonly used in hospitals, especially for treatment of various types of poisoning, classically overdosed with acetaminophen or paracetamol. So in this case, the patient presented with acute H1N1 influenza pneumonia. She was treated with various antiviral drugs. Nothing really seemed to help her until she was administered NAC at 100 milligrams per kilogram intravenously for 3 days, after which she improved dramatically. So of course they stopped this successful treatment and began treating her with oral NAC at 600 milligrams twice per day for a total dose of 1200 milligrams. So she was treated successfully with 7000 milligrams intravenously, and then they reduced her treatment to 1200 milligrams orally, which of course wasn't successful. The patient crashed or crumped after that. Again, they reinstated the NAC intravenously at 100 milligrams per kilogram. Assuming she weighed 70 kilograms, that would be 7000 milligrams per day intravenously. At which point, the patient was then cured and sent home after 20 days. So interesting and successful case report, very supportive data. The authors note that NAC is also safe during pregnancy. Now let's look at another very impressive study from the European Respiratory Journal in 1997. This was a randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trial involving 20 centers throughout Europe. NAC was administered 600 milligrams twice per day for 6 months in elderly and relatively unwell patients. The H1N1 influenza seroconversion was not changed, and I discussed that in the original video, which again you can see at inflammationmastery.com/antiviral. All important clinical parameters improved, signifying major clinical benefits with major financial implications. Frequency experienced a major reduction, severity experienced a major reduction, repeat illness also experienced a reduction, and major and minor problems were all reduced. Certainly this could be used with other treatments, and in my opinion, this study should have resulted in additional research and major changes in healthcare internationally based on this very positive, safe, effective, affordable, and widely available treatment. Now let's look at a few more details from this study. We see that the influenza-like symptomatic cases were reduced across the board, patients suffering from 1 episode, 2 to 3 episodes, and also 4 episodes. All of the original and repeat illnesses were reduced. And you can also see here that NAC had a marked and significant protective effect, both towards local symptoms, such as coryza, rhinorrhea, which is runny nose, sore throat, catarrh, and cough, and general symptoms, especially headache and myalgia, arthralgia. So again, NAC here at 1,200 milligrams per day showed significant antiviral effects against H1N1 influenza. On this page, I'll talk about some of the mechanisms, actions, and benefits of acetylcysteine supplementation. First of all, it's an antioxidant by supporting glutathione. Also, some direct and indirect anti-inflammatory benefits, specifically hepatoprotective. NAC can also be used to support hepatic phase 2 detoxification, which is called conjugation, via its content of sulfur and also via its promotion of glutathione formation. Number 3, it's also mucolytic. It helps to disrupt biofilms. It's anti-inflammatory. NAC also helps to potentiate or support, not necessarily stimulate, but certainly support the effectiveness of the immune system. It's also directly and indirectly antiviral through several different mechanisms. It's antipyretic and lowers fever, at least in some experimental models. It's anti-catabolic and anti-cachexic, anti-wasting, and specifically spares the amino acid glutamine. It's also mitoprotective, which means that it helps to protect and promote and maintain mitochondrial function. It's also been shown to be renoprotective in several different situations. It's also neuromodulatory and neuroprotective. It helps to lower a group of tryptophan derivatives called kynurenines. It also enhances the activity of dopamine while reducing the activity of glutamate in the brain. It also helps to lower homocysteine levels. The amino acid cysteine also suppresses appetite, and NAC has been shown to support fat loss while helping to maintain muscle mass. NAC has also been shown to be effective clinically in the chelation of arsenic and also methylmercury in cases of acute poisoning. And finally on my list here, NAC has been shown to be effective against refractory thrombotic thrombocytopenic purpura and also dengue hemorrhagic fever, which is an acute viral infection. So I'll conclude with a few comments about using NAC in clinical practice for its antiviral effects. By the time patients arrive to more severe grades of viral infection, such as AIDS or acute pneumonia due to viral infections, their catabolism of cysteine is approximately 6 to 7 grams per day, and therefore the replacement of this amino acid should also be in the range of approximately 6 to 7 grams per day. We would not necessarily suppose that replacing 10% of that amount, such as 600 milligrams per day, would be of tremendous benefit. That might work for prevention. I showed you a study that used 1,200 milligrams per day for prevention of influenza H1N1, but when patients are actively infected, they don't always benefit from a preventive dose. They need an interventional dose. Studies that have used lower doses, such as 600 milligrams per day, find modest, safe, and affordable benefits, but not truly therapeutic benefits that people need when they have acute infections. So again, I invite you to take a look at my longer, almost 2-hour video on cysteine and NAC and the treatment of viral infections. A lot of that focuses on influenza virus infection as well as HIV infection. In that video, I discuss what I consider to be the 3 phases of cysteine adequacy which then merges into deficiency and insufficiency, starting with phase zero, which is healthy, then going to phase one, nutritional immunosuppression, and then cachexia and wasting with marked immunosuppression, such as we see in patients with advanced AIDS and cancer. So again, since I've recently reviewed that information, I'm not going to review it here. I invite you to go to inflammationmastery.com/antiviral to see that video for yourself. So now here in conclusion, I'll give you a quick overview of my antiviral protocol. It's founded upon viral pathophysiology. This is a four-part, easy-to-remember model because it's based on what a viral infection is. First, we have to encounter the virus, and the virus has to enter into a host cell so that it can begin replication. So that's part number one, is focusing on virus acquisition and entry. Part number two focuses on inhibiting replication. Part number three of my protocol focuses in on supporting immune function. And then part number four is cellular and systemic support. Now, some of those with certain nutrients, such as zinc, selenium, vitamin A, and vitamin D, we see some overlap there. This more complete model and more complete understanding provides the structure for a more complete and successful treatment plan. Nutritional needs are undeniable physiologic needs. These needs cannot be denied, although the medical profession does a great job of ignoring and sidelining the importance of this information. Ignoring reality does not change reality. We cannot bend reality to the needs of our pharmacocentric egos within the medical profession. Physiologic needs are best met physiologically, not pharmacologically. By virtue of their specific and targeted mechanisms of action, drugs can never provide all the benefits that nutrients can. Nutrients are always involved in multiple pathways and networks, and that's what enables nutrients to provide multiple benefits. In contrast, as I've already said, drugs and vaccines are always highly specific, not only to exact viruses, but actually even exact strains within that group of viruses. Point number eight here, I'm not against the employment of selected drugs when used alongside proper nutrition and biological interventions. In fact, when you look at my book, Antiviral Nutrition and Antiviral Strategies, I actually talk about using various drugs against viral infections, but always alongside a comprehensive diet and nutrition plan. So again, I am not against the employment of selected drugs. I am against the use of drugs when they are selected via medical ignorance and when they are selected for the sake of territoriality and profiteering rather than by appropriate selection based on what is in the best interest of patients. For reasons that span both ethics and scientific knowledge, I am against the compulsory drugging of healthy people, especially when such drugging is advocated by profiteers and bribed politicians. These are not reasons consistent with scientific training, medical ethics, and patient benefit. So again, as I said in 2014, the proof is in the panic. We need to use this new strategy against viral infections. The recent, recurrent, ongoing, repetitive, and predictable international health crises due to viral infections have made very clear the fact that the international community needs to use different strategies to combat these viral infections. The fact that these viral infection health crises exist in these modern times is prima facie evidence of the failure of current systems and the need not for new treatments within the same model, but for a new model better suited for international distribution, disease prevention, and broad-spectrum effectiveness. The multifaceted model originally presented in 2014 in my book Antiviral Strategies and Immune Nutrition, also published as Antiviral Nutrition as a digital ebook, gives us four main areas upon which we can safely, affordably, effectively, and rapidly focus our efforts. Number one, blocking viral acquisition and entry by targeting the virus directly. Number two, blocking viral replication with the use of specific nutrients, such as vitamin D, selenium, and acetylcysteine, supporting immune function, again with nutrients such as acetylcysteine and glutamine, and supporting cellular and whole body health with nutrients such as coenzyme Q10. These interventions have proven effectiveness, low cost, international availability without the cost, delays, limited availability, and adverse effects of current medical treatments. So I encourage you to take a look at my various books, the least expensive of which is the Antiviral Nutrition ebook, which costs approximately $3 or €3. And as I also mentioned at the start of this presentation, this nutrition protocol that I've outlined should be used in human clinical trials, and I'd be happy to support that. So again, in closure now, this has been Dr. Alex Vasquez on March 4th, 2020, talking about antiviral strategies, a quick outline, not a complete outline, but a quick outline, antiviral strategies for coronavirus, deciphering and deconstructing the phenomena of viral infections, insights that lead to better treatments. And again, I really encourage you, if you're interested in this topic, you need to see those other videos that I've posted at my website, inflammationmastery.com/antiviral. Thank you very much for your time and attention.